Hi, my name is John.
And my name is Lloyd.
And we're the hosts of The Pint,
a pop culture podcast.
Lloyd, if you had to tell any of the people out there that might be listening to The Pint for the first time about anything unsavory or disconcerting we might do on the show, what would you warn them about?
Well, sometimes we drop spoilers, and sometimes we swear like motherfucking sailors.
Fuck yeah, we do. You heard it from him. You've been warned.
Listen in.
It is hot as fuck outside. It is summertime here on The Pint. So why don't we do an episode of Summertime 1990s? That's right. That's the little subset we have here where we take a movie from what I consider to be the summer movie season, which is May through August. So May 1st through August 31st, pick a movie that came out between those dates in the years 1990 through 1999 and discuss. My name is John.
Hi, I'm Stu.
And today we're taking to the friendly skies. That's right, today, Con Air. All right, so Con Air is a film that came out on June 6th of 1997, directed by a guy named Simon West. Simon West directed other films such as...
Simon West sounds like a movie character. He sounds like somebody who fought Sylvester Stallone in a movie or something.
He sounds to me like a character Jason Statham would play, like, I'm Simon West. Hello, mate. My name's Simon West, and I'm here to be your worst nightmare. Speaking of Jason Statham, Simon West directed The Mechanic, which was the 2011 remake of the Charles Bronson film starring Jason Statham. He also directed a film we did here on The Pint, couple years ago with a good friend of the show and Pint Insider, Ken Maney from the ODPH podcast, The Expendables Part 2, and a John Travolta film I had never seen called The General's Daughter. He directed all of those. Now, the writer of this film is a nice Italian boy named Scott Rosenberg. That is not an Italian last name. He wrote some films such as Beautiful Girls, which I've never seen, but I know that it has the reputation... like the Timothy Hutton adult character, like, is apparently like kind of in love with a 13-year-old Natalie Portman. I've heard that's kind of what the general idea of this movie is, and that's creepy as fuck. High Fidelity, which is a much beloved John Cusack movie, one of Sir John's favorites. He used to get on me all the time about watching it. I own it on DVD. I've never watched it. Everybody gets on me about that one. And a few years ago, he wrote the first of what are now going to be the three Venom films. This film,
High Fidelity, is that, which one is that?
The one where he is like a serial dater and he owns a record store
with Jack Black.
Yes.
Not the one where he holds the boombox over his head.
That's Say Anything.
Okay. Yeah. I get John Cusack movies confused for some reason. I don't know why.
Apparently. Say Anything was a late 80s boombox in your eyes. High Fidelity is about his, I guess, sex/dating life woes, and he owns a record store.
Okay.
But very popular amongst people kind of around our age group. This film was filmed between July and September of 1996, pretty much entirely in the state of Utah. Towns such as Ogden and Moab and the Bonneville Salt Flats, that's the desert area, kind of in the middle of the movie, and then clearly and very obviously filmed for the finale in Las Vegas, Nevada. Little trivia fact. So this is a Jerry Bruckheimer film. Jerry Bruckheimer films, no matter who they're directed by, pretty much from that time period, have that like big action, glossy aesthetic, right? The Rock, Bad Boys, this, you know, Armageddon, so many of those films. So Jerry Bruckheimer used to have a partner named Don Simpson, and it was Simpson Bruckheimer Films. And Don Simpson died in early 1996. This is the first film that is a Jerry Bruckheimer film, where the actual beginning logo is different. So this is the first one after Don Simpson had died. And apparently, reading about it, Don Simpson, who had co-produced like The Rock and Bad Boys and all these movies with Jerry Bruckheimer, hated the idea of Con Air, which is really weird. Like, I don't know, like Bad Boys is okay, The Rock is okay, you know, all this other crazy shit's okay. But
criminals
then,
taking over a plane, that's absurd.
Yeah, yeah. So he, you know, he passed, and Jerry Bruckheimer went ahead and made it. And Jerry Bruckheimer also, I mean, he's produced everything very famously. He produced the Pirates of the Caribbean films, and that guy's just got it. Like, he must just fart money. There's like no other way to put it. Like, he sneezes and like $1,000 bill shoots out of his asshole. It's insane. Let's get over to the cast of this film.
Shabuya roll call.
All right. Clearly, this is a Nicolas Cage film. If you know anything about Con Air, you know it's a Nicolas Cage film. And you also know that he went with the, obviously it's a wig, but he went with the weird choice of balding with long hair mullet in the back. What do you think of his haircut in this film, Stu?
It's a choice. It's a choice. It looks, I guess, like a guy who was in jail and just didn't get a haircut for a couple of years. I don't know. It's, he says in the movie, he's like, oh, I meant to get a haircut, but I didn't. And why didn't you get the haircut? Because he starts off the movie nice, handsome, clean shaven Nicolas Cage, and then he goes to jail and just decides not to cut his hair ever again for as long as he's in jail. And at the end, he's like, I should have got a haircut before I saw you. Yeah. Why didn't you, guy? Then you could have spared us all. Because it doesn't look handsome. It doesn't look luxurious. It just looks like he has long, stringy, dirty hair because, like, yeah, he's still balding in front.
It looks Southern West Virginia is what it looks. And he also goes with the Southern drawl accent in this. Like, this is 2 years after he won the Best Actor Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas. Leaving Las Vegas was 95, so he won the Oscar in 96. So this is probably one of the first projects he did. And I didn't look up how much he made for this, but this is kind of like, you know, like I always equate it to like Larry Brown, the cornerback for the Cowboys picked off Neil O'Donnell like 2 or 3 times in the Super Bowl and then parlayed it into making millions of dollars playing for the Raiders and just squelching out within 2 years because he wasn't that good. This is like the true sign of like you win an Oscar and you can do whatever you want. And you just start like cashing in those checks, but good for him. You know, Nicolas Cage from Raising Arizona, The Rock, as mentioned before. So he has a relationship with Bruckheimer and Mandy.
I was going to say, in all the weird ass movies he's done in the last decade where his career is kind of revitalized, I guess, but he's doing all these weird indie things. And you're going to see a Nicolas Cage movie tonight. And I'm going to see the same Nicolas Cage movie this weekend. So
long
he's
legs.
Still going. He's still just churning out movies these days. Like, I don't understand how many movies he releases. Like, does he ever stop working? Does he just go from one set to another set and work 20-hour days? Or what does he do?
He must. But remember, he also at one point was in like serious tax trouble. He bought an island. He's doing these movies to cash checks. And I think what's happening is for a while he was doing them and they were almost all like pretty much garbage. And then like something like Mandy comes along and people loved it. And I didn't love it, but like Pig was very well received.
People loved Pig, man.
That movie is not good. I'm sorry.
It would be a good 40 to 60 minute short feature, but it is not. There's not enough content in Pig to be a 90 minute movie. It is badly overstretched out. Like if that movie had come out and been 60 minutes, I probably really would have liked it. But at 90 minutes, I was just like, this movie is stretching out a plot that is not a 90 minute plot past its breaking point.
I beyond 1,000% agree with you. People were going on about that movie and I finally watched it and I went, what? Like, they're like, oh, this is his performance of a lifetime. It's emotional. It's all this. And yeah, he wasn't bad in the movie, but like, what? That's not a great movie. All right, let's keep going. John Malkovich plays Cyrus, the Virus Grissom, the villain of the film. John Malkovich very famously has given shit to this movie basically saying this is like one of the ones he uses to be able to afford to make the ones that aren't going to make as much money. And that's fine, because he's really good in this movie. I mean, he's over the top. He's John Malkovich. He's, you know, very intense. You probably know him from Rounders, Burn After Reading, Dangerous Liaisons. Speaking of John Cusack shows up in this as U.S. Marshal Vince Larkin. Say Anything, I mentioned before, 16 Candles, and a Stephen King film that, again, I didn't love, called 1408.
I've seen it once, and I don't remember having big feelings about it.
Yeah, it just didn't do anything for me. Steve Buscemi is Garland Green, the Marietta Mengler, essentially kind of this Hannibal Lectery type character that shows up in this film. You know him from Airheads, from Reservoir Dogs.
Yes, Airheads.
Airheads is great. And he was in The Sopranos for a season. Ving Rhames plays Diamond Dog Jones, who is a kind of like a militant black criminal that's on this plane, who has his own means to an end, and who's just like woefully, like he doesn't really get to do much. Like it's Ving Rhames. I like Ving Rhames, and he kind of just like there's a lot of these villainous characters, and I wish that he had a little bit more to do, but you know him from Pulp Fiction, the Mission Impossible series, and the remake of Dawn of the Dead, and trivia points as a different character in the remake of the Day of the Dead, the very terrible Day of the Dead remake. He plays another character in that. Rachel Ticketon plays the guard on the plane, Sally Bishop, Total Recall. She was in Man on Fire and FX2. Dave Chappelle, one of my favorite stand-up comedians ever, who just seems to have lost his fucking mind in the last couple years.
Yeah, what happened to him, man?
I don't know, because I love Dave Chappelle. I love Chappelle's Show. I saw him live one time, one of the funniest things I've ever seen, and I just think he's gotten a little bit too... I know that's kind of a lot of comedians' thing, and I don't even necessarily agree or disagree with everything he says, but like he just kind of is putting that ahead of like being funny. And I kind of like hate that.
Right? Yeah, he's like, it's one thing to make transphobic jokes because you're a comedian and you're kind of out of touch with the way society is going. But like, he just doubles down on being a transphobe and won't like back down from having shitty opinions or shitty stances. And that's what the problem is.
Yeah.
Like, you can make bad, shitty jokes if you then recognize they were bad, shitty jokes and like, don't do that anymore. But like, he got told, hey, don't do that. And you can tell, like, he's a guy that because of his wealth and because of his stature and everything has never been told no. So when people started telling him no, he was just like, what's this? I don't understand this, and rebelled against it. Like, it's J.K. Rowling. No one ever told J.K. Rowling no. And when people started telling her no, she just doubled down because she doesn't fucking understand how to be a grown up.
Yeah, J.K. Rowling.
Sorry, I'm ranting about transphobes because they're shitty people.
J.K. Rowling is so rich they don't even pay her in like pounds or anything. They just made they made up special rubies for her. You know, you're the richest woman in Britain. Here's a mega diamond. So yeah, Dave Chappelle plays Pinball Parker. You know him from Chappelle's Show, A Star is Born, and Half Baked. The very beautiful Monica Parker. Like, she's like just like very attractive. She plays Nicolas Cage's wife, Trisha Poe. She seems to have not done a lot lately, but she was in Patch Adams. She was in the remake of The Last House on the Left. I do remember that movie. She played the wife, the mother of the victimized girl. And she was apparently in Saw, which I haven't seen the first Saw in a long time, so I have no clue who she played. But
I don't remember there being a woman in Saw.
Me neither. I haven't seen Saw in a very long time. But that rounds out your cast. There are more people than that, but we're not going to sit here all day long and talk about all of them. So let's get into this movie. Stu, why don't you set everybody up with the general idea of what's happening in Con Air?
Sure. So the general idea of what's going on in Con Air is that Nicolas Cage is I guess he's retired at this point. He's retired and he's done with his service. He's an Army Ranger. And we start off with him being discharged or retired from the Army. And there's a big speech about, you're Army Rangers and you lead the way and you're super kick-ass and awesome. And they goes back home to Alabama to his wife, and she's about to give birth to their kid, and they go out and have an evening together. And there's a hillbilly guy harassing them, and the hillbilly guy attacks Nicolas Cage outside of the bar, and Nicolas Cage just kills him, literally kills him. Not even like, oh, he beats him so bad, kills him. He like shoves his nose bones into his brain or whatever with like a palm strike and just kills this guy. So he goes to jail for 8 years, which is hilarious because he gets the worst legal advice ever. But he goes to jail for 8 years and...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, his lawyer's like, you plead guilty, you'll get 4 years max, of which you'll serve 1 year. You'll be fine. Just plead guilty. And Nicolas Cage doesn't want to, but he does. And then the judge is like, you get 10 years.
Yeah. And the judge goes on this thing. So like Stu just said, I wanted to point out the opening narration of this movie is the speech that like the commanding officer is giving the Rangers as he's discharging them, but it also works as like a mansplaining of what the Rangers are so that, you know that like they're the first that, like when battle happens, they're the first to go in. So we get that. And then the judge, you know, cause essentially he's defending his wife. But like, and these three hillbillies get the jump on him, but then like he starts kicking the fuck out of him, kills the dude. The judge gives him the harshest sentence and says to him, that, you know, it's not the same for you and other people because you're trained and you're like essentially like a living weapon. I was reading the trivia on this and I went a little bit further because I've heard that before. Like, you know, like if you go to, you know, if you're a black belt, you're supposed to like, you know, be registered, like your hands registered, like Bruce Lee. It's bullshit.
Yeah. There's
and not that I ever believed it, but it's definitively bullshit. If you're an Army Ranger, you would not get in any more trouble for what happened just because you were more adept at fighting than anybody else. So
yeah, they lampoon that in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Yes. Brad Pitt's character says, he goes, if I killed someone, I'd be in just as much trouble. Yeah. So yeah, he gets in trouble. He gets 10 years. Now we go through like this little bit. It goes on forever where him and his daughter are writing each other letters. We see prison life. Prison life ain't great. Right? Shit's on fire, but he makes a friend. Shit's on fire. He makes friends with Bubba Gump. He's writing letters back and forth to his daughter. He's also doing like all kinds of like exercises. The most impressive one is one where he's on the ground, legs out, and he's doing like push-ups with his knuckles, with his from a sitting position. I'm like, wow, that's some core strength right there. So we know that Cameron Poe can fuck, you know, he's a tough guy. How long do they ever say in the movie how long he serves? Because I was trying
8 years.
Is it 8 years? Okay,
that's what I heard. Okay, that's what I heard, and I definitively remembered them saying that he was in for 8 years for some reason. So at some point they have to say he was in for 8 years.
Okay, so he's getting out, and he's leaving behind his old partner Odell Bubba Gump, who's his friend, who's a diabetic. That's important. But they're going to be taking the same prison transport plane together to go home, and Odell's getting transferred to a new jail. Now, this plane is populating a new jail. So they're going to be going from different prisons, picking up different prisoners, and bringing them to the Supermax prison. So let's just give you kind of a rundown of some of the people that are on this plane. You get the John Malkovich character, Cyrus the Virus, who they say is 39 years old, which makes me feel old because
I feel
like he can't be 39 even then. I didn't look it up, but I'm like, he's easily 48. You get him. So he is this brilliant mastermind. He's gotten degrees in jail. He's killed 11 inmates. He's just the fucking worst. The Ving Rhames character, Nathan D. Dog Jones, black militant leader, murderer. Bobby Bedlam, this other guy. Who's
Billy
just like
Bedlam.
Billy Bedlam.
Is it Billy?
Billy,
I think it's Billy.
You're right. Straight up murderer. Caught his wife cheating on him, left the wife and the boyfriend alone, and then drove four towns away to kill her entire family and the dog. Let's see, who else did we get? Johnny 23. Let's talk about Johnny 23.
Danny
Trejo. And Johnny 23 truly does not care about what's happening, just wants to rape women. Like, there's like multiple scenes in this movie where, look, I'm not telling you like when's the best time to as a rapist to rape a woman, but he picks the most inopportune times. It, like, while shit's blowing up around them, he keeps on trying to rape the Rachel Tickington character over and over again. They call him Johnny 23 because he raped 23 women. He's got a tattoo on his forearm of a bunch of hearts, and he's just a bad dude. Who else am I missing, Stu, that we have on the plane? Dave at Chappelle. The beginning, Dave Chappelle is basically like kind of like a crackhead, a thief. We get a, you know, it's almost like the Suicide Squad film with Will Smith, where we get like the smart ass CO that we know is going to get fucked up or in some kind of, like, he's pushing these guys around and you know that's not a good idea. Now, Vince Larkin is the John Cusack character. He is the guy who's in charge of this operation going down. But then we meet from Star Trek Deep Space Nine, Colm Meaney, Chief Miles O'Brien, who is a DEA agent who wants to get an undercover agent on the plane. What's that whole deal about, Stu?
I don't know. I never understood why.
Me either.
Okay, I didn't understand what the point of putting this agent on the plane was, but he really wanted to do it. It's not like the guy's communicating with anybody or trying. I mean, he has a recorder on him, so he must be trying to get some kind of information, but he's on the plane, and even in the little bit of time before the plane gets taken over, he's not talking to anybody or trying to get anything, so I was kind of confused as to his existence in this. Not Colm Meaney. Colm Meaney has a, he's like the antagonist of the protagonist. He's the guy who's kind of given John Cusack a hard time and might get Nicolas Cage killed. And, but I didn't understand his little flunkies role. I didn't understand him at all in this movie. I mean, he's there to give the bad guys another gun, but it's just, I didn't understand.
This
movie does a lot of things I didn't understand.
I'm glad, because I felt like there was a line of dialogue. Like, so I understand that in the long run, like, let's just kind of get the whole plot out of the way. In the long run, this, like, kind of drug cartel leader paid Cyrus the Virus to hijack this plane to get one of his cronies or his son, who is going to be a transfer, onto the plane to freedom. Like, that's the end game that we're playing with. So I wondered, is this DEA agent on the plane because, but then the guy doesn't, he comes on the plane later. I wasn't sure. I wasn't sure of the connection, and they didn't make it very clear. We get on the plane, everybody's put into their own little cabins and everything. And it doesn't take long after the plane gets in the air that, like, some weird stuff starts happening. Cyrus, the John Malkovich character, is, like, picking a splinter or something out of his finger, which turns out to be a lockpick. We see, I think, Nate
Dogg. He does the same thing. Yeah, Ving Rhames. He also has a metal splinter thing in his hand that is they use for a lockpick. And Dave Chappelle has swallowed some matches and gasoline.
Yeah. Well, I thought was very weird was he pulls it out of his stomach or whatever. He opens up the bag. And, you know, he kind of apologizes to the giant, like, Native American guy next to him that he's about to set on fire. But there's only one match. Like, don't you think they would have given him, like, five matches in case the first match didn't fuck? Because then your whole plan's done.
Yeah.
So he breaks open the gasoline, he soaks the guy with it, and then he lights him on fire. Now, all while this is happening, Cameron Poe, the Nicolas Cage character, is watching this happen. And he just has this deflated feeling because all he wants to do is get home and meet his daughter. You know, I don't know if we even mentioned that earlier. I mean, I mentioned he was writing letters to her, but his
wife. Yeah, he's not actually being transferred anywhere. For some reason, his sentence is over and they put him on this plane as a way of, like, just transporting him. That doesn't make any sense.
It makes no sense. Like
if when your time is over, they don't give you a free plane ride anywhere. They just kick your ass out on the street and say, like, all right, you're done.
Yeah.
Hope for the best.
When they're talking about him later, when Larkin identifies him as an ally, he's like, he was just catching a free ride home. It's like, really? They took up a seat on that plane that could have gotten another prisoner to that new.
Yeah.
I doubt that.
Yeah. That's not how that's going to work.
No. When he ended up killing the guy in the beginning before his sentence, his wife was pregnant. So he has this daughter that he's never met before. That was the whole bit with writing the letters back and forth. So he sees this happening and then just chaos erupts, right? Cyrus gets out and they kill the co-pilot, take over the plane and tell the pilot, you're going to be landing in Carson City, Nevada. And the idea is at that point, they're supposed to do a swap out for like six prisoners. Meanwhile, in the chaos that ensued, like three of those prisoners that were part of the swap out got killed. The DEA agent ends up pulling his gun. He gets himself murdered because he's super outnumbered, and he uses Dave Chappelle's human shield. And
I have an odd question about that. Does he get himself killed, or does Nicolas Cage get him killed?
What happens there?
Because he pulls his gun, and he and Cyrus have their gun on each other, and Nicolas Cage, like, jumps in front of the DEA guy and starts distracting him and talking to him so that one of the other prisoners can lunge at the DEA guy. Like, Nicolas Cage, 100% gets the DEA guy killed by screwing around.
He did an awful lot of good in this movie. Give him a mulligan on the one guy who gets killed.
He's trying to, like, talk the guy down and make it a better situation, but he 100% is the reason the DEA guy gets killed.
Yeah. Yeah, now that I think about it, you're right. I have a question. I watched what the DVD I owned, which I probably owned for years, and I don't know. I don't remember the last time I saw this movie, but the one I watched was listed as extended, unrated, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's only one scene that, from any time I've ever seen this, that I could not remember being in the original. I want to ask you if it was in the version you watched. Is there a part where, not Cyrus, but I think Ving Rhames' character recognizes Nicolas Cage's character because of a guy in prison that he killed? Did they talk about that in the one you saw or no?
No, I don't remember anything about that.
The black jello? You don't remember that at all?
No.
The black cherry jello? Okay. So after things start going and Poe is, like, you know, working with them kind of like on his own, like he's trying to get, you know, back home, but he's like kind of not trying to throw out that he's not like a badass. And Ving Rhames' character is like, I know who you are, Cameron Poe. I know your name. You killed, and they call him the Giant. And they talk about how he was like the baddest dude in like in that wing of the prison. And he's like, why did you do it? And he's like, he took my black cherry jello. And then, it's weird because it adds a whole nother level to the fact that Nicolas Cage killed a dude in prison, too.
And they're letting him out within his original sentence. You don't get extra time for murdering other inmates.
And they're trying to say it like as if it was like against self-defense. But I wonder, as soon as I saw that, I went, I don't remember this scene at all. And it kind of contradicts like the fact that he's not supposed to be like a murderous dude and that this was an accident that happened once. And then he's like very nonchalantly talking about how he murdered this guy over black cherry jello. Like, he took my jello. And I'm like, this scene was not in the original. Okay, I'm glad that you said
no. That's definitely not in the version I saw unless I dozed off for 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, I dozed off for the last 20 minutes. I had to rewatch the last 20 minutes for sure. I was very comfortable on my couch this morning. All this stuff is going on. What's the problem with Odell? Why does he have to get Odell the safety?
Oh, during when the criminals overtake the plane, it's right whenever he was going into a diabetic fit. So the one, I think it was the female guard was coming to give him an insulin shot. And then all the mayhem went down on the plane and all the syringes got busted. So there's no way to give him his insulin. He has the insulin medicine in a little packet, but there's no way to inject him with the insulin. So he spends the movie going into a diabetic fit.
Getting a little worse off and worse off. So they're going to land in Carson City. Cyrus now has to come up with an idea as to how to swap out some six white men for the other people that are going to be coming on and not tip off the guards that are there. So they're all wearing guard uniforms. The plane does eventually land, and Cyrus ends up disguising a couple of the guards that were on the plane with spit bags over their heads to swap out. Now, as the swap out is happening, it's during a sandstorm, so it's harder to see. The Dave Chappelle character ends up taking the transponder from the plane off of the plane and going into a little mini airport and putting it on a sightseeing plane. And that's kind of the last we see of him for the most part in the movie, because he never gets back on the plane as it's leaving in a hurry. But we will talk about that in a second. We get more people coming on, and one of my all-time favorite character actors comes on at this point, MC Gainey, who plays Swamp Thing, who is the pilot who is going to be taking the plane up, because the pilot of the actual Con Air plane is one of the guys they swapped out over with a spit bag on his head to the authorities. So they need a pilot. Swamp Thing comes on. He's able to fly them out. They also get a very effeminate Latin guy who clearly is probably going to be the amusement on the plane. They cut those scenes out. And then we get, Stu, out of left field, the Marietta Mangler. Tell us all about Garland Green.
So we have Steve Buscemi playing this guy who gets boarded on the plane with like a kind of a leather daddy version of the Hannibal Lecter mask. And we're told that he'd murdered like 30 some people up and down the coast or whatever. And he's pretty dispassionate about everything. And he for whatever reason, everybody else is wearing like blue or orange prison colors, and he's wearing a pristine white outfit that nobody else has. It's just him. He's the only one who's earned this this white outfit that he's wearing. And yeah, he's just presented as like, even compared to Cyrus the Virus, he's the big threat, the big madman of this plane. He's the real dangerous major league criminal. The movie never bears that out.
I kind of like that, though. You know why? Because in this movie, we see Cyrus do some pretty hardcore things. You know, he hurts people. He kills a couple people. Is Cyrus the one that kills the guard with the handcuff through the neck? I can't remember if it was him or if it was Billy Bedlam, but like at the beginning when all the stuff is happening, the handcuff opens up and he kills a guy, like putting it through his neck. That might be the unrated version too. Maybe you didn't see that.
I don't remember that, but it could have happened so fast. I might have missed it. I don't know.
It's actually a little bit longer and maybe it is unrated because he's digging into the guy's neck. But anyways, we see Cyrus, we see Billy Bedlam kind of be a bad guy. We see all these guys be bad guys. And then the worst of all of them, we never see him do anything. Like he doesn't like attack anybody. That we see at one point, there's a guard that's chained up near him when he's finally let free, and they don't show it, but he kills the guy. At another point later on, when they land, he has like a tea party with a little girl he meets, like who lives in a trailer park, and it's like very Frankenstein and very threatening.
Yeah, it's very uncomfortable, and they tease that he might have killed the girl, but just for like a minute or two until the movie clarifies the little girl's okay.
Yeah, absolutely love the conversation between him and Nicolas Cage. Where they're just sitting next to each other, and he looks over, and Cameron's like, "Hello, Garland," and then he just starts talking about like, you know, what is insanity and like what's crazy and is it crazy to work 50 hours a week? And then he's talking about like he's like, "I drove through 3 states with one girl's head that I wore like a hat in my head,"
yeah.
And Cameron's like I can't talk about this right now. we got a lot of good actors in this doing some good stuff, but overall, it's. You know, it's mayhem, or it's not a Michael Bay film, but mayhem at its maximum. I mean, how would you describe the overall sense of action in this film? Because it's like there's so many explosions and fucking planes landing in the dirt. Like, I admittedly love movies like this, but there was something about this one that, like, I was almost begging for more hand-to-hand combat. It was all stunt-worthy stuff. Did you feel the same way? Like, it was very extreme?
Yeah, you don't really get a lot of fisticuffs or anything in this movie. It really is like, yeah, like, there's the... It feels like there's a scene out of Nightmare on Elm Street where they land in the... What is it called? The Lerner Airfield, where the cars are all piled up, and like I said... Not a Nightmare on Elm Street 4, and they blow the cops away, and it's more explosions and planes crashing into things and planes crashing just a few feet away from a giant propane tank and gunshots and planes crashing onto the Las Vegas Strip. Yeah, there's not a lot of fisticuffs. It's a lot of big bombastic action scenes.
Chappelle's character puts the transponder on that plane. The plane takes off with a group of sightseers. And the Cole Meany character is convinced that that's the plane, that's our Con airplane. So he gets some attack choppers, and they follow that plane accidentally. Vince Larkin figures all this out because he finds the plans for everything inside Cyrus's jail cell, inside like a false wall.
Yeah, how did he get a bomb?
I know. And as soon as I've seen this movie before, but clearly when he says "don't touch anything." And those guards are like, and the one guard sits down and is like, "Oh, I'm going to open this up." And the other guard's like, "Don't touch that." He opens it up, and it's one of those like Die Hard with a Vengeance bombs where like all the stuff starts filling into the bottles. So, but Vince Larkin figures this out. So he takes Cole Meany's like 63 fucking split back like Corvette.
I know we already made fun of the name Simon West, but Vince Larkin sounds like a car dealership. Come on down to Vince Larkin and get yourself a new Cadillac. Yeah. I don't know why. I think there actually is a car dealership somewhere in Pittsburgh here called like Sturman and Larkin. And so every time I kept hearing Larkin, I was just like, this guy's going to sell me a car. I don't trust him at all.
Vince Larkin Chevrolet, 100%.
Yeah, Vince Larkin Chevrolet. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. So he figures this out, and he goes to the Lerner Airfield because he knows that's where they're going to be landing for the next changeover, which is where they're going to drop off the drug lord who came on board.
How does he know that they're going to Lerner Airfield?
Was that when he finds, how does he figure that out? Oh, he looks on the map and he just sees Lerner Airfield and he figures it out, right? Like, he's like, they're going to turn around and go there.
Nicolas Cage chucks Dave Chappelle's body off the plane, and he writes a note on his white t-shirt, Lerner Airfield, Con Air, gonna fucking land. I don't remember exactly what he wrote, but he writes the note to Detective Larkin, Lerner Airfield. I just love the idea that's like, you're in an airplane and you're chucking this body off. And in my head, I'm just like, that body's going to explode.
Yeah.
Nobody's reading that. Nobody's ever going to read that shirt.
I forgot about that. So Swamp Thing tells Cyrus that they're not going to make it to the airfield on time because there's drag. And he says it's because the landing gear is not all the way up. So earlier when they had to escape from the last place, the last airfield they were at, Pinball couldn't get back on the plane. So then we see Nicolas Cage and I think Diamond Dog, the Ving Rhames character, go to the landing gear, and Dave Chappelle is stuck in it. He got up in the landing gear and then like froze to death. So they decide to drop him out. So he writes the note and drops him out. I'm sorry. Like, okay, so we get a scene of like these two like older white people in like a Mercedes or a Volvo complaining about bird shit. Okay, that's fine. That's like very typical, like kind of like these type of movies.
But that's a very Michael Bay kind of joke thing in this Jerry Bruckheimer movie. So it's very much like Jerry Bruckheimer too.
Yeah. But I gotta be honest, just the visual of Dave Chappelle's body like falling out of the sky is fucking hilarious. So Larkin goes to Lerner Airfield. Now, speaking of like just the general mayhem of this film, all of the stuff with John Cusack at this airfield as he's trying to stay out of sight of anybody. But meanwhile, he's dodging planes almost landing on him. And like when something explodes, like, you know, like a manhole cover flies over his head. It's like a goddamn like Three Stooges episode with him. This is where the drug dealer tries to double cross Cyrus and take off in the plane that was meant for the two of them. But Cyrus ends up, stopping that and killing the guy. What does he do? He sets him on fire, right? Like there's gas coming out of the plane.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. The plane's about to take off. And Vince Larkin gets in like a crane and
giant crane machine and chops the plane in half.
And as the guy crawls out of the wreckage, there's gas. He lights him on fire.
And he's like, Cyrus, I was coming to get you.
Sigh. And then he goes,
Anora.
Sayonara.
There were two good lines in this movie. They both took place at the Lerner Airfield. It was the sigh, Anora. And then there was, I don't know. I really like the one line Nicolas Cage delivers where he's like, I only trust two people. One of them's me. The other one's not you.
Yeah. I think the famous line from this movie that most people would quote is put the bunny back in the box. He has a bunny he bought from the prison commissary because he's going to meet his daughter on her birthday. It's in like the lower holding area. And Billy Bedlam at one point figures out that he's actually a parolee and is threatening to tell Cyrus, and he has to kill Billy Bedlam. But of course, Billy Bedlam's holding the bunny and, you know, better put the bunny back in the box. So all this is happening. They get up in the air again. The cops show up. They manage to fight the cops off again. Does someone throw a chain on the plane? The plane ends up hooking by mistake the Corvette.
And I think Nicolas Cage does that. Nicolas Cage, like, he has a big rope from the plane and he ties it around a big cement pillar trying to stop the plane from taking off.
And they shoot the cement pillar, it breaks off. But then as the rope's dragging, it goes through like that building and picks the Corvette up. The Corvette is gets pulled through the air tower and then like smashes in front of Colm Meaney, another laugh a minute section. Now the plane is having multiple problems, though. Swamp Thing, the pilot, is like, you know, we're going to end up crash landing in Las Vegas. They're close to Las Vegas. So all this stuff is going on. At what point?
And all the good guys have coalesced at this point. Colm Meaney and the guy that he's with and their helicopters, along with John Cusack, who's also in a helicopter at this point. They're all chasing Con Air at this point. They've all come together and Colm Meaney's like, shoot it out of the sky. And John Cusack's like, no, Cameron Poe is on that plane and he's trying to help us.
Yeah, it's really literally, except for Cameron and Odell and the guard. There's nobody else good on Con Air. Yeah. And I do get it, but like, let's talk real life. They would have shot that fucking thing down in a second.
They would have, and they should have. Like, John Cusack is 100% wrong, because I know this is one of those movies where we see the destruction, but we don't see any of the ramifications of it. But you watch this plane crash onto the strip, and like, how many dozens or hundreds of people got killed or severely injured on that crash landing onto the strip? And we don't see that because the movie doesn't want you to think about it. But Cole Meany was 1,000,000% right. They should have shot that stupid plane out of the sky.
Yeah, Larkin is definitely like, he's thinking with his nice brain and not like logic at all.
Yeah, like, he's like, I made a friend.
He's got to get back to see his daughter on her birthday. It's like, and all the people that were like in Vegas celebrating their daughter's birthdays that are dead right now are on you, Vince Larkin Chevrolet. Yes. You really fucked them over. The plane crashes. They end up in Vegas. Before the plane crashes, somebody shoots Odell. Is it Cyrus? Does he shoot Odell? Right.
Yeah, because he realizes somebody on the plane is selling them out and feeding Vince Larkin information. So he says, like, I'm going to find out who's on my team right now, because he threatens to shoot the guard, the female guard. And so to stop Cameron Poe from outing himself, Odell jumps up and says, it was me. I did it.
Right. And he shoots him in the stomach.
Yeah.
He does make it, though, right? He lives. He when they get off, like, doesn't he get taken away in the ambulance, I believe?
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's go with that.
I feel like he lives. And then meanwhile, I mentioned it earlier, but there have been like 14 rape attempts by Johnny 23 on the guard. It's just getting brutal. Plane lands and, Cameron gets out of the plane crashes. Cameron gets out of the plane. You know, everybody's kind of getting out of the plane, and we see Cyrus the Virus. He kind of gets out of the bottom of the plane, and what does he hitch a ride on, Stu?
A fire truck. Swamp Thing ends up driving somehow. I missed however Swamp Thing got the fire truck, but he got a fire truck, and he's driving it, and Cyrus is on the back, like on top of the ladder.
Pretty much a fact of life is this. When you read a news article or see it on the news that a plane went down, everybody on board that plane died. It's just unfortunately a fact. Plane crashes are pretty fatal. This plane has crashed twice in one day, and nobody died in the crash. When they crashed in the desert at the Lerner Airfield, the plane got buried into the sand. There wasn't like a moment where they're like, oh, four of the guys in the back that were helping us out like broke their necks. They all lived. This thing crashes on the fucking Las Vegas Strip. Malkovich is okay. Swamp Thing is okay. Fucking Odell's been shot, but he's okay. Everybody's fucking survived two plane crashes at this point.
Yeah.
It's absolute insanity. So then he's getting away on the fire truck. Poe and Vince Larkin Chevrolet jump on a couple of police motorcycles and chase him down.
That's right. They just abduct police motorcycles. Yeah, because you see the two cops like turn around and go, hey.
Oh, I was having my donut. So chase him down, and eventually Cage, his character, Poe, he gets on the fire truck, right? And
yes.
What the fuck? They end up getting into a fight on the fire truck. And then eventually the truck crashes, right? And John Malkovich lands in a hydraulic press like the Terminator. How did that happen?
Yeah, he lands in like a pneumatic pump that like pumps his head into the ground. Yeah. Who is it? Is it Vince Larkin that gets the hose from the thing and he puts it in the windshield and he starts filling the...
Yes, the cab of the fire truck. Yes. Yeah, yeah. He drowns Swamp Thing, or at least drowns him out. Cyrus gets killed. There's a lot of like industrial shit going on in the fight scenes in this movie. In the very first scene of the movie, when Cameron Poe is fighting off the hillbillies that are threatening his wife and him. Like, did you notice, like, they're right next to a working oil pump?
Yes, yeah.
Something is shooting flames into the sky. I'm like, this is the most movie set ever. Like, there has never been a movie set more fucking, like, primed for a fight scene ever. So Cyrus is dead, and now Cameron goes back to the strip, and he has his meet cute with his wife. His wife, did you notice, like, she seems very uneasy around him? Like, she's probably, because earlier in the movie, when he defended her, she makes a comment about like you're not the old Cameron, right? Mm-hmm. Like not the kind of guy that would kill a guy over black black cherry jello, right? And he's like, no, baby, I'm you know, the army got rid of that for me. And she's kind of very uneasy around him. And the daughter's afraid of him. And he gives her the bunny. And they have an embrace. And the fucking Leanne Rimes.
I was going to say Leanne Rimes plays again. That's the second time in the movie they play How Do I Live Without You?
Yeah, drop that banger, that four quadrant banger. And Vince Larkin is watching. And the movie essentially ends. But here's something we forgot. We forgot that we never saw Garland Green again. Pretty much after the plane crash on the Las Vegas Strip. Did he get back on the plane after he had the tea party with the little girl?
Okay, yeah, so after the tea party, he gets back on the plane and he gets out in Vegas. Isn't that the last scene of the movie is him shooting craps?
That's what I wanted to bring up. Stu, how do you feel about a movie where they make it very clear that this guy is like the worst murderer ever? He's probably killed little kids, and it's almost like supposed to be a funny, cute stinger. That
it
he's
is.
Like,
it's supposed to be like, feel good that this guy got loose at the end and he's not part of it. I don't know how you're supposed to feel about that. I don't know what the movie wants me to feel, but it's portrayed as like, oh, good for him.
I feel the same way. I feel like they're like, oh, Garland's out. Cool. Yeah. And like, cause he's like shooting craps. There's like an attractive woman standing next to him. You get like this queasy feeling the way it's shot. It could have been done so much better if they just shot it a little bit differently.
Yeah.
You know, cause what they could have done is they could have shown that. And then had one more scene showing like Nicolas Cage at home, like his home life is good, like a year later, even if it's quick, if they want
Garland
you to leave.
Garland Green kills his family.
Yeah, well, no, it's just leaving it on the Garland Green note is fucking bizarre.
Yeah.
It's very bizarre. So, okay, so that is 1997's fucking Con Air. Let's talk about the box office.
What's in the box? What's in the fucking box?
All right, this had a $75 million budget. That entire budget went to paying Nicolas Cage and buying enough shit to blow up and crash, because there's a lot of blow-ups and crashes in this film. Week ending June 6th through the 8th of 1997. At number five, it made $2.9 million. 2 weeks it had been out for, Gone Fishing. Joe Pesci and Danny Glover.
Oh.
I had to look this up. Didn't know what it was. Number four, it opened that same week. $3.5 million. Buddy. It is.
It's the Child's Play remake.
No, Rene Russo. And she has like an orangutan. Like,
what?
Yeah. It's a thing. Look it up. number three, out for 3 weeks. $3.6 million. It's a rom-com starring Matthew Broderick and Meg Ryan called Addicted to Love. No idea.
Mm.
No idea. Number two, it had been out for 3 weeks, $18.5 million. The Lost World, colon,
okay.
Jurassic Park. And opening at number one, of course, you didn't doubt this at all, $24 million was Con Air. So Con Air, this is really weird. Con Air domestically ended up making $101 million on a $75 million budget. Probably the advertisement budget wasn't that much, so it made its money. It made $101 million domestically. Internationally, and this is on boxofficemojo.com, it says it made $24,000. I can't believe that in 1997 this didn't get released wider in the world.
Yeah.
But also, if it did get released in another country, was it in like five theaters for a weekend? Like, it made $24,000
somewhere. That's crazy.
It's very weird. I didn't get too deep into it, but like, yeah. maybe if you're interested, check that out. If you want to know what kind of a good summer Nicolas Cage had, June 27th, 3 weeks later, Face Off came out, and that made $23 million on its first weekend. So a big action weekend for one Mr. Nick Cage. All right, let's rate this fucking thing.
Watch a few movies, take a few notes. It was fun.
All right, I'll go first. Nicolas Cage, I like Nicolas Cage. Like, you know, clearly, as we said earlier, he's diluted his brand so much that, you know, you never know what you're going to get anymore. But back in the day, it was pretty much like, we're probably going to get something above board, pretty good, right? He had a couple of action films in a row in those couple of years. I much prefer The Rock to this. I love The Rock. The Rock is like, we're going to do The Rock on here at some point. The Rock is just like fucking really solid. You know, you got Sean Connery added to the mix, so kind of boosted up a little bit. I've always liked Con Air, But on this viewing, I realized I don't like Con Air as much as I think I thought I liked Con Air. It has all of those staples of that, like, mid-90s to early 2000s, Michael Bay-ish, Jerry Bruckheimer production, and I love that stuff. I love that glossiness. I love the action. I love all that stuff. But there are many movies that were done in that oeuvre that were done better than this. A lot of good actors in this movie, right? Ving Rhames, fucking. I love Danny Trejo. I love John Cusack. Cole Meany is great. Fucking Nicolas Cage. John Malkovich. There's a ton of really good actors in here, and there's a ton of cool characters too. Like, you know. But what we don't really have here is a great action movie, right? There's no gunfights really in this thing. Not a lot of fisticuffs. It's mostly vehicular action. It's very chaotic. The first 25 minutes of the movie is all set up, which is fine. And then we just get like this kind of really chaotic action piece after action piece. And none of them are like super memorable. That's the problem with movies like this. You got to have something like you think, like we talked about The Rock a second ago, that whole bit where at the end where they're going to bomb Alcatraz, Nicolas Cage comes out of the fucking bunker with the fucking flares, you know, and the planes fly over. There's like big action beats that you remember from these things. And honestly, I didn't get too far into it, but like, I almost feel like that ending fire truck bit was like reshot or added on. It felt added on, like almost like they crashed and they're like, we need one more thing. Like we got to have them fight one more time. So yeah, for that, I enjoy this movie. I had a good time watching it. It definitely wasn't like one of those things where I'm like, oh God, this isn't over yet. But I think I'm probably going to go closer to like a 2.75. It's fun. Nicolas Cage is clearly giving it his all, you know, with that accent and with that hair and with that tank top. But yeah, overall, it's a 2.75. Stu, what do you think of 1997's Con Air?
I think you're stealing my thunder a little bit here, because I went into this movie when you said we were going to do Con Air. I've seen Con Air once before. I gave it either a 3 or 3.5 on Letterboxd. And I remember thinking like, oh, this is a really fun movie. This has a lot of big, funny, out there, really extreme action sequences. And I'm going to have a good time watching this movie. And I started watching it this time, and I'm watching it and I'm watching it and I'm watching it. And I'm like, this movie is very long.
It is long. I didn't notice that, but yeah, it's long. It could be cut easily.
Yeah. Oh, you could chop 25, 30 minutes out of this and it'd be fine. But it's just, I don't know, this time watching it, I just thought it was okay. I didn't think any of the big bombastic action sequences this time, I didn't think they were like hilariously adorable. I just thought like, all right, this is just generic 90s action this time. Stuff happens. The actors are good. They're giving decent enough performances. I wish Ving Rhames had more to do.
Yeah,
I wish wasted. Steve Buscemi had more to do. And I don't know, like I'll end up giving it a 2.5. That was my updated score on Letterboxd. Like, it's fine, but like, yeah, if you compare this to The Rock is so much better. If you compare this to Face Off is so much better. And it's fine. It's fine. It's not a bad movie or anything, but it's overlong. And like you said, a lot of the action sequences feel the same. It feels like here's the plane crashing again. Here's more explosions again. Here's Cameron Poe might get caught for being the guy on the plane who's feeding information again. And it's just, I don't know. It needed to be edited. It needed to be edited down and just taken care of. And it's okay, but it's not as good as I thought it was the first time I saw it, which wasn't even that long ago. Like, we're talking since COVID. I saw it for the first time since COVID and I liked it a great deal. And I watched it this time and it did not strike me the same.
Yeah, we're
maybe this just isn't a rewatchable movie.
We were all very bored during COVID, so every little bit of entertainment, like maybe added like a letter grade. You know what I mean? Like a C became a B because like COVID.
Yeah,
and I 100% agree with that. Every once in a while, doing this show, we'll review a movie that I hadn't seen in a long time that I'm convinced I liked more at one point in my life. And then I watch it and go. And sometimes it's happened the opposite, where I'm like, mm-hmm. Hey, that was better than I remembered. Another one I did with you that really sticks out to me as that having happened was over on the Patreon when we did the Friday the 13th films, the remake in 2009. I enjoyed that when it came out. I enjoyed that.
You were wrong.
Yeah, I enjoyed that.
Oh, you enjoyed it when it came out. Okay, yeah, I liked it when it came out too. Then I rewatched it and was like, no, this is bad.
I enjoyed it when it came out. I enjoyed it like a year later when I saw it on DVD or whatever. And then we did it and I was like, no, this isn't good. Like, this was not good. So every once in a while that happens. Like Con Air is a better, is a lesser example where it's still a decent movie. It's still watchable. But yeah, I can't picture me like going, I'm in the mood for some fucking really good bombastic action. Let me put in Con Air.
I'm going to put in Face Off every time or The Rock. I'm not going to put on Con Air.
Yeah, it's definitely
the lowest. Give me an example of something that went the other way, though. Something that you watched in fairly recent memory where it was better than you remember. Because I have one off the top of my head. A movie I had meant to rewatch for years. Because I really didn't like it the first time it came out. I saw it in theaters. I didn't like it. And it's another movie I rewatched since COVID. And upon rewatching it, I was like, oh, this is as good as people say it is. This deserves all its plaudits. Gladiator. Yeah. I did not like Gladiator the first time I saw it.
I love Gladiator. Yeah, I love Gladiator. So that one for me. You know, it's another one that you were on the episode for, and I'll just pull it because it was recent. I've always liked it, but I liked it more this time. 89 Roadhouse, the original Roadhouse. Okay.
Yeah.
It's always been one of those ones that I'm like, that's a fun movie. But like, I actually had a lot of fun doing it for the show, and maybe because we did the remake first. We did the remake first, and I'm sorry, but the remake, you know, and you agree.
Remake's rough.
The remake is fucking bad. Yeah. So like, maybe seeing the original right after the remake and kind of getting perspective on it a little bit.
But that's how good a Roadhouse movie could be. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, man. You're like,
yeah, I think my Roadhouse score, and it's another movie I watched twice in a fairly short succession of time, but it went from like a 2.5 to over a 3 the second time we watched it. I definitely liked it more the second time.
Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. All right. So now that we got that out of the way, you know, us, we're the Pint. You can find us wherever, blah, blah, blah. Don't worry about it. What I do want you to worry about is listening to Stu over here, and he's going to tell you where you can find all of his stuff right now.
The podcast is The Stu World Order, where we review random comic book movies. It's on all your podcast players. Go check that out. And the website is swoproductions.com, where we have new articles every single weekday, movie reviews, some fiction, some TV show reviews, episode by episode. So go check out swoproductions.com.
And today is the 11th of July as we record. And the reason I'm excited tonight is because tomorrow's the 12th, which means it's a new Stu World Order episode.
Oh, it is.
Stu on the twos.
Yeah.
Stu on the twos. Your last episode, or at least I know I've heard all your episodes.
The current one is Barbed Wire.
Oh, okay. So I listened to Barbed Wire. Your one before that, The Phantom with Mark Wade was awesome. He was very good. I love that movie. I know you guys were both kind of like middling on it, but it was a real good conversation. Your shows are always excellent. But like Mark Wade and J.M. DeMatteis, like a lot of the, you've been pulling them, man. You're pulling them. Do you have anybody else like on the hook right now, or are you just
no, nobody big coming through right now?
All right, well, we'll just wait. We'll wait. Keep listening to Stu on the twos, and Stu, say the words.
See ya.
It's over, Johnny. It's over.
Nothing is over. Nothing. You just don't turn it off.